Hello, listeners, and welcome to the AfriWriter podcast, where we look to celebrate African history, people, and culture by telling our story. As always, our hope is that it fills you with enough curiosity to go and do your own deeper research. Karibuni to any new listeners to the AfriWriter world. We invite you to check out previous AfriWriter episodes, which can be found on this podcast platform. Today, we're headed back to part two, to Eastern Africa to meet the Rwanda Kingdom. A shout out to my East Africans out there, AfriWetu has landed on your borders. Before we begin, please remember to visit us on our socials. Our handle is at AfriWetu across all of them. But for now, just sit back and enjoy the journey. Amahuru. That is a word that is not only used as a greeting today, but also holds another deeper meaning, that of a story, a historical story. In part one, I spoke about how I would be the narrator of the Ibitekerezo of my ancestors, the official court histories which are shared as poems or songs. I will try and do them justice as we reflect on the past. Let's get to it. The modern location. The best thing for all of you who are listening in and have your maps ready is how easy it'll be to locate the modern kingdom's location. Now, look at the eastern part of the continent, and right there, in there where the Great Lakes, the interlacustrines are, where modern-day Rwanda is, right there, that AfriWatu is close to the borders of our Rwanda kingdom. So, a quick recap. Last time we covered a lot, so I would urge you to go and have a listen to that episode. But since you're already here, stay on as I'll give the briefest of recaps because we have a lot more to cover today, but at least you won't be too lost. So we heard about the origins of the kingdom, which has a healthy dose of myth and fact within it. We heard about the Bimanuka, those who dropped from heaven. We heard about Sabitsetse, the one who was forced to flee his home, and his two step-siblings, Mututsi and his sister Nyampundu, who decided to join him. We then heard of how on landing, they met the Zigaba clan, who owned the land. He, our Sabitsetse, then changed his name to Kigwa. Kigwa had a descendant called Kihanga, who is considered to be the founding father of the Rwanda kingdom, and as a last time, he will also have his own legends episode in the future, that is Kihanga. We then spoke about the importance of clans and how this was how one felt was their true sense of identity and pride for all, and in fact, it depended on what clan you're in, which would also inform your social status. And the clan we heard about that had held the most coveted status was the Nyinginya clan, from which the Mwami, the Rwandan king, traditionally came from. I know that's a lot I've packed in, right? It is here we then looked at society, we touched on its stratification and the different people and the labels given to them. We then met the royals, the Mwamis, their wives, the Mwami Kazis, and the powerhouse title of Umugabe Kazi, the queen mothers. We shall meet them again later today. And so let's continue with this meeting of my ancestors. But go and listen, it was so dope, I promise. So now we have the recap sorted, let's go across and have a look at how the governance worked by first taking, as you know, a trip to the past. We have arrived at the official inauguration of the new Mwami. To one side, we see the poets who have been specially chosen to attend and perform at the event. They are accompanied by the sounds of drums, tambourines, and the insengo, the clay whistles, massively played by the best of the best musicians in the kingdom. The Abiru have gathered. The time has come, our guide, a noble woman from the house of Rusimbi, tells us. What time, we ask, totally clueless as she guides us through the grounds to our designated spots as guest of Bottega from one of the noble houses. As we sit, she fills us in on what's going on. So, she starts, the old mommy has gone to be with the ancestors, and now our Abiru have come to tell the courts who is their chosen clan for the next Umegamikazi. She continues, if you look to the right of them, at the other group of nobles in there, those are the old mommy's confidants. They'll be making an announcement soon. She then directs us to our spot. Look, she says, over there by the royals, you'll see the instruments of power for our kingdom. These are passed on from mommy to mommy. There's the royal drum and scepter, which is controlled by the Abiru, and the new mommy will be given these as well as have their Ishungwe, the royal headdress, and the Rutare put upon them as part of their regalia. Suddenly, there is quiet. The officials are speaking. There is a murmur of congratulations going around. The next mommy has been chosen. We hear the name Mutara, but we lose the rest. We ask our guide. She tells us, ah, yes, you heard right. His name is Mutara. Now, that is his title. On becoming a mwami, you're either given Mutara, Chirima, Kigeri, Mimbambe, Yuhi, and this depends on where you are in the naming line, but it also tells us what kind of ruler you should be and emulate. The kingship is sacred, but not divine, as he has to follow our culture in his reign. It is sacred because he represents Imana, who is the essence of our lives and our supreme being. She continues as she leads us back to the edge of the capital as we say goodbye to our Bottega hosts. The confidants who made the announcements, the ones leaving, are the ones who the old mwami gave the name of his successor. They are the Umutsobe and the Umutege and the army chief. We bid her goodbye and in a flash, we're back. So, the kingdom was ruled by the mommy, the king, and who was a co-regent alongside the Umugabekazi, the queen mother. The two were supported by the royal court, which contained representatives from the named clans, with three clans classed as the ritualistic clans. These were the Tsobe, the Tege, and the Kono. These clans were known as the Abiru. We shall hear more about them later in their religious capacity, but in a more secular role, they had the important role as the official kingdom's royal historians, where they were trained to carry out their role using poetry and music. They were in charge of the sacred, very complex and elaborate royal codes, one of the key institutions. These codes were memorized by them and passed from father to son. And as we saw earlier, they played a critical role in the decision of who would co-rule with the mwami and even consulted who the next mwami would be from his Igikoma Ngomas, the princes. The kingdom followed a system of Ubuhake, where the tributary states were subject to the centralized hierarchical authority. The smaller settlements were led by either chiefs or heads of the lineage who had a range of responsibilities, which included handling the tributes and the official offerings, leading the sacred rituals to the ancestors, as well as the annual harvest festivals. When it came to the day-to-day, they ran the administration and also acted as jurists in cases from small claims to family matters to the larger, more serious offenses. The other arm of the government was the military. They were not only deployed in the battlefields, but also played an administrative role in the kingdom. We shall look at them in a few just after we cover the religion section of this kingdom. Cool? So when it came to religion, the supreme power of the kingdom was Imana. And was also sometimes referred to as Rugaba, he who gives, Rutem, he who creates, or Rigira, he who makes possible. It was from Imana that the Mwamis traced their roots through Kigwa, who left heaven and came down with the skills of fire, farming, and foraging of tools. It is also from Imana that we hear the story of how day and night comes about. It is said that as the earth gets older, it grows weaker. It is then killed off by a powerful being who then chucks it across the galaxy into the heavens. And at this point, Imana revives the earth and in it all through his power and puts it back to where it was. The powerful being again destroys it, and so this cycle continues. It is through Imana that Amwami claimed their sacred role wielding religious authority in the kingdom. They were the kingdom's protector, and their role was to keep their subjects safe from the dangers of war and invaders, from malicious spirits, any chaos and destabilization, as well as any other threats to society. This protection included him sacrificing his life for the people if necessary, an act called Umutawazi, an act of helping the people. Aside from active protection, the Mwami was also expected to bring blessings, and one of the key actions was making it rain. Linked to Imana is the Ryangombe sect. Ryangombe was actually said to have once been a powerful man with control over a region south of the kingdom during the era of Mwami Ruganzu Ndori. In time, his dominion was ended, and the circumstances around this were strange. In fact, in one version, he was killed by a woman who turns into a buffalo. In another version, there is still a buffalo who rams him into some trees, and then the trees hold him down and kill him. His followers, those who didn't follow him into the underworld, elevated him to ancestor spirit status. He is said to be a spirit who could be both malevolent and powerful, able to heal and protect his people from illness and ailments for good harvest, victory, and then rain disaster on their enemies. Moving from here, we go back to the Abiru, whom we heard of earlier. Mwami Rugwe has been credited with introducing/appointing them as official guardians of the rituals, and they grew and held great influence and power in the 17th and 18th centuries in the royal courts. They played a key role in the kingdom's royal courts, not just operationally, but also spiritually. It's worth stating that although the title and role played by an Uwiru was hereditary, it was not necessarily guaranteed. The father would have to present his intended heir to the Mwami and get royal approval. The Abiru's duties were as healers, guardians of the royal tombs, and they held key religious duties, such as they were historians of sacred rites, as well as being the main actors in the Mwami's inauguration and funeral rites, as it was they who had the power to convene the spirits of the kingdom's ancestors. And speaking of our ancestors, in the course of my research, I came across a powerful female deity who was in some versions seen to be even more powerful than Imana. Her name, Nyabingi, which loosely translates means either having many things or being able to provide. And to this day, she has a following in the Rastafarian world, with special music attributed to her as the inspiration, and it's called, you guessed it, the Nyabingi Order. Now, she has an interesting origin story. It is said that she started off as a mortal queen, and she was very wealthy with her own right, and it was this wealth that attracted her husband. Can anyone say gold digger? Anyway, because this dude basically married her to get his hands on her riches, he didn't stop there. Oh no, Afriwatu. This guy was not only a truly rubbish husband, which is kind of not a surprise, but his greed was much. He wanted it all. And to get it all, he murdered our queen. But this was not the end of her story. In fact, it seems her story only just began, because from here, she was then transformed into this powerful deity whom we now know as Nyabingi. It's a dope story, right? And on that note, let's move to the next section, the military. The Rwanda Kingdom had a very effective, fierce, and professional military, one that permeated all levels of society. The elite warriors from specific clans were part and parcel of the royal courts and incorporated into the ruling class. These would then include the commanders in the military who were royally appointed army chiefs and were allowed to get a share of the spoils of war as reward for their loyalty and successful campaigns. On top of this, even those who served under them as whole regiments were given land and cattle allocated to them, and this would increase based on their regiment's success on the battlefield. In fact, the act of cattle raiding was encouraged and carried out by special forces, incentives to keep up good work, right? Now, as awesome as the Rwanda Kingdom's military was, with war stories for days, in this section, we shall look at them close outside of the purely military function and look closer at their more governance and administrative role in the kingdom. So the armies were deployed across the kingdom and in their downtime from the battlefields acted as political administrators and intermediaries with the central government. Once the territory was captured, the military had a governance function. Being as they were deployed regiments across the kingdom, they were on the ground to collect tributes, police the people, support or control the leaders, either the new ones or existing. The army was trained in both military and non-military skills. The latter was necessary to carry out their civilian duties. Thus, training ranged from the expected like fighting skills, trained on use of armory, battle formations and such like, to public speaking, debating, farming, construction, and even in the arts, more specifically the Intore dance. We shall come back to this in a sec. There were also expectations of how to conduct oneself as a soldier both on and off the battlefield. You had to show ubutwari, bravery and courage, be of ubugabo, masculinity proven through honor and good moral fortitude, and have itonde, being careful, having self-control and poise. Losing composure was truly frowned upon. When off the battlefield, a soldier was not to use violence. They were to be generous to those who are less fortunate and treat them well, keep their word, and basically be an honorable human. Then you could be considered an umugabo, a man who encompassed all these qualities. I mean, something we should all aspire to, I reckon. When it came to their duties, the military carried out the distribution of supplies to the different parts of the kingdom and also held the pastoral duties. Cattle was very important in the kingdom and the military. I mean, there were even specific battle formations named after specific herds, like the Abashakamba formation from the Umuhozi, or even the Uruyange formed from the Ingenyo. Now, let's just go back for a quick look at what I mentioned before, Intore, a concept that till today still holds a very special place for both our ancestors and my generation, before we leave this section of the military, okay? So this term was first used during the reign of Mwami Mutara Rongera, who is said to have introduced it as part of his rejigging of the military. There are a number of meanings, all related to the military, for Intore. For example, one is a recruit, another is an elite warrior, with Ingamo used for regular warriors. The meaning I wanted us to explore is that of the Intore dance, which I mentioned earlier. There is a story I will use, which I pulled from an article titled The Story Behind the Intore Dance by Gaston Nsanza Bagaonwa, a Rwandan historian. So the story goes, Mwami Rongera received and granted asylum to Muyange, a royal refugee, who with his followers had fled from the Busoni. Amongst his followers were the talented Abayange dancers, who in the course of their stay in the kingdom put on a show for the royal courtiers. Their performance was lauded and loved by all those who gathered, which included the military heads. And they say the best form of flattery is imitation or something like that. Well, the military incorporated the Abayange dance styles into their fighting tactics, like actual fighting styles. Now that's impressive. They didn't stop there, they went further and also included the dance style into their own military performances. These performances were specially dedicated art forms at festivals or ceremonies like the Kuvuga Machumu ceremony, which is talking about spears, where they would use poetry, music, and dance to tell of their epic battles and acts of heroism and adventures. The Ntori dance was very popular, with all the soldiers from all walks of life taking part. And I will quote from the article, Mzee Kamuhangire, a celebrated Ntori dancer from the royal days of Mutara Rudahigwa. Every body movement and gesture of Ntori dancers is symbolic, and all the symbols are attached to fighting tactics and armory, which gives the dance privilege from all Rwandan societies. Dope story, right? And with that, let's dance our way from the military and into the kingdoms and expansion before we close with the demise. So in the 15th century, the arrival of the Nginya's ancestors in the region heralded a shift in the political dynamics. The Zigabo were at the time the powerhouse in the area, controlling as they did a majority of the region. It was they who gave land and accommodated the guests. The guests settled in at Gasabo at first, having landed at Mbari on entry, and made Lake Muhazi the base of operations. And it is from there that they grew and expanded their territory. The expansion happened in a number of ways. So, for example, in the first instance, there's the relatively peaceful settlements of the new pastoralists spreading out across the region. With this came the intermarrying of folk, another more subtle way of expansion. Then, of course, the well-known traditional method of military conquest led by warrior mwamis. One of the more prolific mwamis to lead this was the celebrated Mwami Ruganzu II Ndori. We met him in part one. He set the stage and the foundations for what would become a formidable military, which then became the pride of the kingdom in their successful campaigns and raids. He was then followed by other notable mwamis like Yuhi Gahima, who was known for taking the Sera drum from the Mubari and leading major and successful raids on the north, west, and south. Fun fact, he and other mwamis with the prefix Yuhi were all buried in a designated area in the royal grounds of a particular city. Then, in the 19th century, we had the very famous and revered ruler who has been compared to Ruganzu Ndori, one Mwami Kigeri Rabugiri IV. Another famous mwami who had a really huge impact on the kingdom. By the end of his reign, he had conquered the lands of rivals and extended the kingdom's reach north, east, south, and west. For his part, he conquered Buhibi in the southeast, Bushibi, Butembo in the west, the area around Lake Kivu, Rusiziki, Nkore, Lake Rweru area, Burundi to the south, and the Bahima, just to name a few of his successes. And overall, in the course of the kingdom's existence, it had conquered, absorbed, gotten under its influence many territories. Now, with all of this high, what happened? I know, right? Considering what we know of the kingdom. Well, I think it's always fun to start with the soothsayer, Nyira Bioro, and her foretelling of the kingdom's demise. She posed two questions to the then Mwami, which we shall look at, and then look at what her questions really meant, because we Africans do love a good parable, right? It was during the era of Mwami Kigeli wa Ndabarasa. And this is my version of how the questions were asked, or rather, how the conversation went. Nyira Bioro, Mwami. The kingdom's fortunes are soon to change, and these will cause the end of our kingdom. Surely not. What could possibly cause this? How can I stop it? I'm sure I can. Tell me, Nyira Bioro, what do you speak of? Mwami, what will you do when the grass on both sides of the path will grow so high that it will meet? Ah, I will have one of my sons return the herds, of course. Ah, I see. She really didn't. So, what will you do when your people will develop spots on their hands that can be deadly to them? Kigeli replies, "For my people, I will offer one of my sons, Bitare, to save them. And if that is not enough, I will sacrifice an heir to the throne." Nyirabiyoro, seemingly satisfied with what she has, that she has shared what she can, moves on to other topics. Her work here is done. Now, for the meaning of her questions, because again, as I say, we speak in parables, we as Africans. Let's start with the grass. So the deeper meaning was that the herds of the kingdom would be decimated by a bovine plague, which in turn would mean that the grass would grow and grow wild, as the cattle wouldn't be there to eat it, obviously. And then when it came to the spots on the hands, that was the next plague, which was that of smallpox. It would affect the people and kill them off. And it is actually said that the Mwami's two sons, both Bitare and his heir, died of this plague. So as you can imagine, these two epidemics weakened the kingdom at a time when there was the onset of the colonialists interfering on the continent and in the region. At first, Kigeli was not overly concerned about the latter, but as he and many of our African ancestors soon came to realize, the colonialists did not come in peace, but to grab and destroy. It wasn't until much later that the demise really went into freefall. There were a few contributing factors from our Rwandan kingdom side, like the fierce internal conflicts within the lineages during Mwami Rwabugiri's era. He was able to manage them in his lifetime, but upon his death in 1895, so died the future of the kingdom. He had been able to hold tight to the many lands and conquests of the kingdom, but after him, the kingdom just wasn't able to retain this hold. It also didn't help that his successor, Mwambwe Ritarindwa, had been usurped by Kajongera, who, get this, was his adoptive mother. Ouch! And she did this so that she could place her young son, Musinga, on the throne. His mother, Nyiraburunga, had died, and so Kajongera was appointed to be his mother by the late Mwami. Well, by his father. And her coup was not really a polite coup, but to be fair, are there any? Actually, no. She and her male kin relatives held a very bloody coup. It was known as a fight between the kings and queens of the kingdom, killing off any potential rivals. This was called the coup of Runshunshu, 1896 royal coup. Runshunshu was actually the location of where Rutarindwa had moved his palace, and when the battle was over, his palace was burned down, the royal drum destroyed, and he had died. It is claimed he took his life. So outside of the clear problem of, you know, overthrowing her surrogate son for her other son, this issue brought to fore what was a root issue with her. Our Kanjogera had been given the title of Umugabekazi, essentially in error. First off, it was interesting because she was from the Abakagara lineage of the Abega clan, a clan that had serious beef with the Abanyinginya clan, which I'm sure you all remember was a clan where all the rulers hail from. So that was the first odd thing. Then the second thing that was unusual about her position was that she had it all, because she already had her own son, so she should not have been given this powerful role when it wasn't her own son on the throne. And clearly we can see why, right? So we can already see how this internal conflict damaged the kingdom at its core, because the coup was bloody, killing people. It was not fun. But even more woes were to come. At the same time all of this was happening, colonialists, get this, had claimed the kingdom as their territory all the way in Europe. Guys, can we just take a moment to digest that fact? African lands, our ancestors' African lands, were being divvied up in some nondescript city across, up in the cold north, off the continent. The audacity and sheer madness, when you sit and really think about it, it's a bit crazy. Anyway, Kajongera's son took the title Mwami Yuhi Musinga. As he was still seen as the son of the dead Mwami, he was still able to keep the throne. Unfortunately, the damage had been done, and from here on out, the Rwanda Kingdom had essentially ceased to be. And by 1931, when he was deposed and sent into exile, his son taking the mantle as Mutara Rudahigwa, he came to rule Ashel. And now, before we wind up, let's take a look at what else was going on in the world at this period. In 1505, Martin Luther enters St. Augustine's Monastery in Germany and begins his journey to instigating the Reformation. 1520 to about 1566, the reign of Suleiman the Magnificent marks the zenith of the Ottoman Empire. In 1521 in Belgrade, which is present-day Serbia, is captured by the Ottoman Empire. In 1524, the German Peasants' War in the Holy Roman Empire. In 1770, there was a famine in the Czech lands which killed hundreds of thousands. In 1771, the plague riot in Moscow. In 1816, Shaka rises to power over the Zulu Empire. In 1810, the Mexican War of Independence begins. In 1857, the Indians mutiny against the British. In 1895, Abyssinia defeats Italy in the First Italo-Ethiopian War. In 1820, Liberia is founded by the American Colonization Society for Freed Slaves. So as we bring it home, I have deliberately moved from an overuse or emphasis of using the classifications of Tutsi and Hutus in this and part one of this kingdom, as I believe these terms have been manipulated and not for our good as Africans, or indeed what was our ancestors' intentions. I am a typical blend of an African with roots I can trace to both the Great Lakes and the Great Mountains and the Great Valleys of East Africa, one of which is my Tutsi heritage. So when I say that this is not academic, but truly from a point of connection to the story, I hope it lands. It was such a wonder to go behind the scenes and see my ancestors through a fresh lens. And it was one of the reasons I do what I do, because many a time we know only a fraction of the story, especially of the Africans' story, which is told to us not by us. And this honestly has never ended well for us. So I encourage you, dig deeper, find your ancestors' stories, and there I promise you will find yourself. And to sign off, I want to quote the famous and prolific warrior Mwami Chinema II Rugungira, who said, "Urwanda ruratera nitureterwa." No nation invades Rwanda. Instead, Rwanda defends and attacks nations. And until next time, Mubarikiwe. Oh,